You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. And I'm your host, Robin Johnson. And today, I'm very pleased to have the author of a really, really important book about our government and our politics. It focuses on events from about 15 years ago, which I think the longer I go on and study our politics, this was a critical era for explaining what's going on right now. The book is called Arc of Power, Inside Nancy Pelosi's Speakership 2005 to 2010. The author is John Lawrence, and he's with me today. John, thank you so much for taking the time.
I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks for inviting me, Robin.
This was a very interesting period, a lot going on. But let's just start and give the background here. I want to turn it over to you. You were the chief of staff of Nancy Pelosi, very powerful position. Take us through that time. What were the major events going on starting out? And just to give our listeners kind of a background, a reminder of where we were at in our country's history then.
This is a very critical time, as you pointed out, Robin, for Democrats in Congress. And I should point out, I am currently a professor, and I really try to stay away from proselytizing the Democratic view or the party view or the Pelosi view. I'm really trying to look as objectively at this period as I can. But from the standpoint of Democrats in that era, they had been out of power in the Congress since 1994. And they were struggling to regain power after the first 6 years of the Bush administration. And Pelosi had become the Democratic leader in the early 2000s with the hope of breaking this trend of losing election cycle after election cycle. And she did that in some very novel ways by putting a lot of emphasis on ground operations and by trying to unitize the Democratic message, which was a very tricky thing to do among Democrats and then particularly between Democrats and Republicans. And finally, in 2006, a couple of things were able to result in success. One was growing public frustration with the war in Iraq and the Bush administration. And the other was a worsening economic situation. And there was actually a third factor, which was a series of corruption scandals that affected not only Republican members almost exclusively, but that involved the Republican leadership as well. And so Democrats were able to find a unified message the idea of a new direction for the country, more transparency, more accountability. And Democrats won that election, won the House as well as the Senate. And then we're in the situation where you had divided government. You had Republicans in the White House, Democrats in control of the House and the Senate. And you had to find a way to govern. And it was a period of time where there was still a significant level of partisanship, but we can talk more about this, obviously, it was a different level of partisanship. There was still, I would argue, a high level of institutional interest within the Republican Party in governing. Certainly that was a George Bush's perspective. That was John Boehner, the Republican leader's perspective. And what happened was that over the course of the next 2 years, where you had this divided government, the Democrats had to do a lot of explaining. Pelosi had to do explaining to her people that notwithstanding the fact that he had campaigned on ending the war in Iraq and other dramatic changes, health care and whatever, that, as we say, you campaign in poetry, but you govern in prose. And Pelosi, who hates incrementalism as a philosophical approach to governing, nevertheless understands that, as she says, around here, some people want to make pate, but we usually make sausage. It is a give and take. And it's one of the reasons she's such a success. She was such a success as speaker in both her iterations. And so she had to effectively unify the Democratic caucus to get much less than they thought they were going to get. They couldn't end the war in Iraq. They couldn't even pass conditions on the funding for the war. They were trapped into a situation where they had to continue funding because you can't abandon soldiers in the field, obviously, because President Bush used his veto to make sure that the conditions that would force a withdrawal did not go into effect. So there was a tension there, but there was also a sense that you had to rise to the level of being the congressional majority and govern. And that meant doing things that you didn't necessarily want to do. Certainly Pelosi's constituents didn't want to do, but it also divided the Democratic caucus. She was uniquely skilled at holding Democrats together. The crucial moment, I would argue, in that period, and to some extent in the book, is the fall of 2008, where after a lot of warnings that things were going south in the financial markets, you had this cataclysmic challenge facing both President Bush, who Pelosi and Democrats had criticized for not reining in the financial services industry more quickly, and Democrats who now had to fashion just 6 weeks before an election. 6 weeks before an election, you had to come up with a plan to basically give about $700 billion to the most unpopular human beings on the planet, the very people who had precipitated the financial meltdown in and of itself. And while there are certainly historical and economic challenges that you can raise with the solution that was come up with, as there are with any legislative solutions, what you ended up with was a bipartisan effort to prevent the greatest collapse of the American economy and almost certainly the world economy since the Great Depression. And I point that out in the book and to my students constantly as indicative of the fact that the institutions of government, while they're flawed and they're problematic, and we have some very good people like James Madison and Alexander Hamilton to blame for that, nevertheless, they do work, particularly during crisis era, but they work best when you have people in charge who are able to make it work. And so that election, of course, ended up with the election of Obama and the Democrats retaining the majority by very large margins. And then they were able to do things that they had come closer to promising: healthcare and the major stimulus bill and the legislation addressing jobs and climate change and the banking industry. But, and this is sort of the point of the book, when you exercise power, when you make big decisions, and particularly, and this is really important, particularly when the minority party decides it's not going to participate, it's going to leave it up to you. You've got the big majorities, you've got the White House, you've got unified government, you do it. Then all of the problems also fall to the majority. And very often, this is sort of where the title of the book comes from, the exercise of power means that you end up losing power. And Pelosi's philosophy always was, look, when you're given power, you use it. And you use it as effectively as you can. It's never going to be as much as your core constituency wants, but you use it to as much as you can. And you run the risk of losing. And of course, Pelosi lost. And that is the arc of power that the book speaks about.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I want our listeners to understand that arc of power, which you just described. But here we are, 2008, Obama's elected, large victory, hope, optimism. That was kind of his campaign theme. Take us back to that period, John, and you talk about the beauty of our democracy and how it's set up. And I want our listeners to keep this in mind as we talk about this, that they designed this government to act slowly. I think that's a fair comment. Slowly, why? Because they were concerned about heavy-handed government. That was a lot of the concern, the compromises at the beginning of the country. But anyway, take us back. Obama's elected. You had majorities in both houses, but this cloture rule in the Senate, which played a major role in what got done and what didn't get done.
Yeah, so cloture refers to the way in which the Senate, under Rule 22, allows for the Senate to decide to dispense with cloture and move forward. And the rule at this point only requires 60 votes. Democrats had 60 votes in 2009, very briefly, because you had the late seating of one senator because of a disputed election in Minnesota. And then you had Ted Kennedy dying, and you had only a short time before Republicans won that seat. So you had this narrow window, and it is in those situations where you have those super majorities in both houses, more important in the Senate than the House, that you are able to pass these kind of sweeping legislation, particularly if you're not going to get any help from the minority. And the minority made it very clear that whether it was the stimulus or healthcare, they were there to be obstructionist. And they were not going to help. Now, that doesn't solve all your problems, because as political scientists know, the bigger your majority, the more it means that you've got multiple factions within your majority. That's how you got to be the majority, right? You already had won all the low-hanging fruit. You know, we had all the liberals we were ever going to elect in the House and the Senate. You had to win moderates in order to get those big majorities. And those moderates don't have the same perspective, the same constituencies that the liberal factions do. And so you have to force compromises. And that's a difficult thing for political parties to deal with, as Speaker Johnson is discovering, as Speaker McCarthy discovered, that you have to tell the large bulk of your party, the liberals and the Democratic Party, the conservatives and the Republican Party, that they can't get it the way they want it, because there are factions within your own party, even if you don't want to worry with the other party, that have to be mollified. And certainly getting the kind of margin that we had in the House, and that 60-vote margin you needed to pass this legislation in the Senate, absolutely necessitated compromise that was beyond anything Pelosi wanted or Obama wanted, or for that matter, Harry Reid wanted. But you also raise, Robin, a really important point, which I try to illustrate in the book, and that is the existence of that filibuster rule, which incidentally, important for your listeners to know, that is a self-imposed rule by the Senate. There's nothing in the Constitution about the filibuster. The Senate could end it tomorrow, as they did modify it in 2013 and 2017. That gives the Senate enormous advantage in the fashioning of legislation, because they say, look, the only thing that can pass is whatever can get 60 votes in the Senate. And that creates great tension between the House and the Senate, because I think with the electorate to some extent as well, because they see 55, 56, 57 senators saying this is what we want to do, but one or two people can say no, and that's the end of the discussion. That's, for example, what happened with the public option. The late Senator Lieberman, who just died, he was part of that 60 votes, and he said, absolutely no, I will not support the public option, even though a majority of the Senate wanted it, President Obama wanted it, and a majority of the House wanted it. And so that came out of the bill. And that's the sort of thing that fuels resentment between, and it's one of the things that I try to deal with a lot in this book. And that is, it's not just Democrats versus Republicans. It's Democrats versus Democrats. It's Republicans versus Republicans because of the ideological heterogeneity of the parties. But it's also personalities banging into each other. And it's also the tensions between the House and the Senate. So it's an institutional a rivalry. And it elevates even beyond that. I tell the story in the book of a phone call between the Speaker and President Obama after the healthcare bill, where she had to swallow a lot that she didn't want. And he senses there's tension there. And he says, what's the problem? What's your problem with me? And she says, you don't respect the House. And what she meant by that is you defer to the Senate. Now, of course, as I would say to the Speaker, yeah, well, he doesn't have any choice, because if he doesn't have 60 votes in the Senate, we don't have a bill. She knew that. But it is that institutional advantage the Senate gives itself, which complicates the ability to pass, even when you do have significant majorities in the House, Senate, and in public opinion. And that builds frustration, I think, with the institutions of government.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is John Lawrence, who's the author of a very important book called Arc of Power, Inside Nancy Pelosi's Speakership, 2005 to 2010. If you're Republican, please tune in. Don't just turn off here, because this book takes you inside our government, inside the halls of power. And the lessons, it provides civics lessons for both parties, regardless of ideology. Keep in mind, we just talked about Joe Lieberman and a few senators tanking the public option in healthcare. John McCain tanked the repeal of Obamacare. So it's the same thing on both parties, where you have these the intense partisanship, where they almost have to have only votes within their party to pass things, and you're bringing together a lot of diverse philosophies. And so this is a book at its heart about American democracy, I feel, and American government, and it takes you inside the speakership and Nancy Pelosi. So it's a great book for everybody. That's my point, I guess, I'm making here. We go through, again, the arc of power, as is in the title of the book. The Democrats get control. They pass some things, including the Affordable Health Care Act. But then the arc of power that you described takes over to a degree, and they get shellacked in Obama's terms in the 2010 election. Was that avoidable, John?
Well, I'm not sure it was. You know, we knew that we would lose votes on the Affordable Care Act. We knew we would lose votes over the aggressive legislative activities that we had taken. But we had a 43 seat margin, and so we thought there was some opportunity. We didn't think we were going to lose that many votes. And I should point out, for those people who think, well, all politicians care about is getting themselves reelected, in the book, I relate conversations with members like Tom Perriello, a first-term member from Virginia, who knew that by voting for these Democratic initiatives, he was going to jeopardize himself. And Tom said, if the worst thing that ever happens to me is I lose my seat in Congress because I extended health care to 30 million people, I can live with that for the rest of my life. You know, people do give up seats in Congress. People do vote on principle. But of course, the election of 2010 was devastating for Democrats, and it raises an important overall point in terms of the operations of government. It's what I write about, and I call the implementation gap. And what I mean by that is, and this is I think very much what happened to Democrats. Think of the Affordable Care Act was not that popular in 2010 because nobody had gotten any benefits from it. It didn't even go into effect until 2013. Most of the jobs that were created by the Stimulus Act that was passed, one of the first things we did in 2009, didn't kick in until 2011, 2012. And we knew that that was going to happen because it took time to get jobs and construction infrastructure up and ready. You run for office with the promise you're going to do something, or you run for re-election, you say, look at everything I did. And what happened, I think, in 2010 with two things. One was people were not very, there were a lot of people who were very unhappy with TARP and with the bailout of the financial crisis. They don't realize, incidentally, that as problematic as that may have been, number one, it prevented a depression. Number two, because of Democrats, we included, and I was part of the team negotiating, that all the money had to be paid back with interest. And the government actually ended up making $100 billion in profit from the TARP. It was a tough way to do it. And we didn't deal with other issues we should have dealt with. And we wanted to, but we couldn't get them passed, like mortgage relief. So that's one of the problems. The other problem is this thing called this implementation gap. You run, you say you're going to do things, they don't come into effect. And then you run for re-election. And in the House, you're running for re-election after only 2 years. And our advisor said, well, don't tell people you did all these wonderful things because they don't see the benefit of it. And so we were stuck on the one hand, not being able to talk a lot about what we had done. Well, you certainly didn't want to suggest that you hadn't done anything. And so Democrats were really in a bad situation in the 2010 election. The other thing that happened is because of TARP, we saw an energizing of both in I think, many people believe the rise of this hard right wing in the Republican Party was attributable to the Affordable Care Act. I argue in the book that it was more attributable to TARP. I think that's where people saw the government step in and help, quote unquote, the bad guys, the guys who had, they weren't aware of all the things that were in the legislation to protect taxpayers and recoup the money. And what happened as a result is you had an energizing of this Republican hard conservative base And a mollification of the Democrats, who felt they didn't get what they really wanted out of either TARP or the healthcare law, and they didn't see the benefits of jobs. And so Democrats chronically have this problem where, because Democrats pass legislation that creates new programs at a much faster rate than Republicans do, and Republicans are less invested in governmental intervention and programmatic creation, Democrats constantly have this gap of time between the passage of legislation and the time that you see the benefits of that legislation. And it's nowhere clearer than the Affordable Care Act. It was barely, I don't think we even had a majority support in 2010. Today, it's supported by over 60% of the public because they have the benefits of not losing coverage when they turn 26, or pre-existing conditions, or subsidization of premiums or expansion of Medicaid. So that's a real institutionalized problem that I think Democrats, and particularly House Democrats, face. Senators a little easier. They've got a six-year term. Only a third of them are up and accountable so quickly. And there is a ramification of this, incidentally, for Republicans as well as Democrats. I told a story in The Arc of Power. I knew John Boehner real well. We had worked together on the Education and Labor Committee, where he was the chairman. I was the staff director for the Democrats for 5 years before I went over to the Pelosi office and before he became the Republican leader. And I ran into him right after the 2010 election. He was going to be elected speaker. I was congratulating him. And he said to me, "John, in 6 months, I'm going to be more popular in your caucus than I am in my own." And he proved very prescient about that. And the reason was that anger that boiled up in 2010 elected that Tea Party group, it's now more the Freedom Caucus group, and they were very anti-institutional. They viewed John Boehner as much of a problem as they did Nancy Pelosi, because they saw him collaborating with the Democrats, and they saw the pressure of the old line Republicans pressure. And that's the group that's moved out of Congress for the large part and been replaced by a much more ideological and partisan group of Republicans. I'm not pointing the finger one way or the other. I'm just saying John Boehner saw that trend coming and saw those deep divisions in the party. And that's the reason that Boehner was forced out. Ryan probably would have been forced out. McCarthy was forced out. And now Johnson faces such divisions, while Democrats remain firmly united behind Pelosi. And now Hakeem Jeffries didn't even have any challenge when he moved up to become the leader. That's an institutionalized problem that Republicans are facing. And it's why in the passage of most legislation today, they're passing it with Democratic votes, not with Republican votes. It's kind of an ironic situation.
I think you just made a great point on TARP. I mean, I've studied the last 10, 15 years in politics a lot. And my contention is I do think it goes back to that period. And I do think TARP, more than the Affordable Care Act, really provoked this anger to grassroots. Obama was elected and people felt hope, people felt change. And then, TARP was passed, the banks were bailed out, but individual people weren't. That was the message. And when people ask me, did all this start with Trump, our current partisan divide? I say, no, I think it started in this period here. Would you agree with that, John?
I actually argue that it goes back to the 60s and 70s, where you started seeing the parties realigning more along ideological lines as a result of a series of political developments: civil rights, the rise of cultural divides, anti-war activities, the rise of the evangelical right, the elevation of deficits and spending as divisive issues. I mean, there's a whole line of them, but it certainly comes into closer focus. First in the 90s, I think Gingrich, who I respect as a political tactician, really articulated how to compel people, push people to make choices. If you go back to 1950, the American Political Science Association issued a report that said the problem with American politics is that the parties are too bipartisan. They should be more partisan so voters know what they're getting for. Well, now we've gotten what they desire.
Be careful what you wish for.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it just makes it harder to collaborate, harder to cooperate when the parties stand for radically different things. And, again, as you pointed out, it's not as though Democrats were all that united behind this the TARP legislation either. We wanted to have much tougher penalties, for example, on the executives who had precipitated this crisis. The Bush administration said, absolutely not, you know, reining in golden parachutes and bonuses. And within a year of TARP, the AIG and others were handing out these monster bonuses to the very people who had managed the accounts that had precipitated the crisis. But we couldn't do that. We also, Mrs. Pelosi and the Democrats were very adamant that we needed a stimulus component. That was, the Republicans said, we won't support that. And they also said, the Democrats also said, we need mortgage forgiveness for low-income people who got into these very bad loans. Actually, one of the first conversations the speaker had with President Obama when he took office was, you better make sure that your administration really aggressively promotes mortgage assistance. And the administration never did. And we think that was part of the problem with the way the public understandably viewed TARP. The people who precipitated the crisis, who made all the bad decisions, ended up getting a lot of money. We got the money back, but I don't think that changes the underlying notion that the government responds really well when the guys at the top are in trouble and when the average working person needs help, suddenly it becomes a much tougher lift.
We've run out of time already, and folks, we barely scratched the surface on this book. I will just say that the last chapter in the book that is titled The Perishability of Power is one of the best I've read on government and the structure and functioning of our government. And John, you've done an excellent job in this book of maintaining objectivity, even though you worked for Pelosi. This book is for everybody to read, and it's got present day applications. And I think it's really, really an important piece, an important book to contribute to what's going on now in our politics and government. So again, it's called The Arc of Power, Inside Nancy Pelosi's Speakership, 2005 to 2010, written by John Lawrence, who served as former Speaker Pelosi's chief of staff. John, thank you so much for coming on Heartland Politics today.
Thanks. And I just want to, if I could take 1 second and just say, one of the things that's unique about this book is that it's based on 9,000 pages of notes that I took during the private meetings and conversations that I was a party to for that period of time. And so readers are going to hear personal interactions and conflicts and confrontations and belly bumping and all the things that make politics really interesting that just don't make it into most histories or into the news account. So that was a major motivation to write the book in the first place. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.